Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Dan Novak presents this week's education report. He tells us about a newly developed English language assessment, or test. Later, we hear the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, we have a story on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the recent attack on her husband. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Monday that last month's attack on her husband will affect her decision on whether to remain in Congress after the midterm election. The midterm elections were held Tuesday. The Democratic leader also called on Republicans to stop the misinformation that is fueling political violence. And she urged Americans to vote to defend our democracy. In an interview with CNN, Pelosi did not say what her plans would be if her party loses the House majority. But many believe Pelosi and others would step down. Pelosi was filled with emotion when she described the attack on her 82-year-old husband and the sadness she felt for the country. "I'm sad because of my husband, but I'm also sad for our country," Pelosi said. "I just want people to vote, and we will respect the outcome of the election, and I would hope that the other side would do that as well." Pelosi spoke about her husband for the first time publicly on the day before the midterm elections. Democrats are struggling to keep control of Congress at a time of rising threats of violence against lawmakers and concerns over the U.S. election. Pelosi was asked whether she had made a decision about remaining in Congress. "I have to say my decision will be affected about what happened in the last week or two," Pelosi said on CNN. Some Republicans, including the son of former President Donald Trump, and even new Twitter owner Elon Musk, have made fun of the attack, despite the seriousness of it. "There has to be some message to the Republicans to stop the disinformation," Pelosi said. "We want the country to heal." Pelosi's husband, Paul, was attacked 11 days before the midterm election by a man who broke into their home in San Francisco, California. Officials said the man was looking for the speaker before hitting Paul in the head with a hammer. The attacker told police he wanted to talk to Speaker Pelosi and would break her kneecaps as a lesson to other Democrats. Paul Pelosi suffered a broken skull and other injuries in what officials call a planned political attack. Pelosi said the hammer hit her husband in two places, but did not enter his brain. Pelosi said he would have a long recovery. She said the attack on her husband of nearly 60 years was fueled by misinformation that has no place in our democracy. Pelosi told CNN that she was very scared when she learned about the attack early on the morning of October 28th. I'm thinking my children, my grandchildren. I never thought it would be Paul, she said. David DePape is being held in San Francisco jail. He pleaded not guilty to attempted murder and other charges. He also faces federal charges of attempted kidnapping of an elected official. Officials said DePape allegedly broke into the Pelosi home, woke up Paul Pelosi, and demanded to talk to Nancy. When Paul Pelosi told the man his wife was out of town, DePape said he would wait. After Paul Pelosi called 911, the phone number for reporting an emergency, officers arrived to see the two men struggling over a hammer. Then DePape hit Paul Pelosi at least once in the head with the hammer. DePape later told police he wanted to kidnap the speaker. He threatened to injure her, to show other members of Congress there were consequences to actions. Pelosi has said little since the attack on her husband, but she spoke in an online call to activists late last week after her husband was released from the hospital. People say to me, "What can I do to make you feel better?" I say, "Vote," Pelosi told those on the call. Next is this week's Education Report with Dan Novak.
Cambridge University Press and Assessment is partnering with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, on a new English language assessment. The goal of the new assessment is to improve understanding of how English is taught and learned as a foreign language. The assessment will be part of the OECD's program for international student assessment, called PISA. PISA is a worldwide study every 3 years that measures student performance in math, science, and reading in the native language. About 80 countries take part in the study. PISA will be adding a foreign language assessment in 2025 as part of the study. So far, English is the only foreign language that will be used in the assessment. It's a fact that English is the language of communication, of study, of work, spoken by billions of people, Hanan Khalifa told VOA. Khalifa is a language learning and teaching expert with Cambridge, and one of the leading experts on the PISA foreign language assessment. So it wasn't surprising to use English as a foreign language to start with, she said. Khalifa calls the new test groundbreaking. She said large studies of English language teaching and learning have been limited. There was a study in the 1970s by the University of Gothenburg in Sweden looking at English as a foreign language. And Cambridge was involved in a 2000 study among some European Union countries that assessed teaching and learning foreign languages. Cambridge has tested English teaching and learning in individual countries, but never on a worldwide level. The PISA assessment, administered all over the world with participating countries, gives us really, really rich data, Khalifa said. Until now, there has not been a reliable data source about the levels of the abilities of people who would speak English. She said the data will help countries make decisions about how to use resources. Without good data, it can be hard to know whether countries should center their efforts on developing study programs training teachers, or introducing students to the language earlier, she said. The PISA study is only given out to 15-year-old students who attend the school system. The test will center on assessing real-world, everyday English communication. Khalifa said the test is not about whether your grammar is accurate and whether your vocabulary is spot on. She added, "It's about whether your message has actually been communicated to the other side or not." The test will be entirely online and through a computer. Students will be assessed based on their English language ability. Students will speak into microphones for the spoken parts of the test. OECD piloted the assessment in 5 countries in 2021, and Khalifa said it was a success. Katalina Kovacevic is with OECD and was involved with the pilot program. She said in a statement that we were concerned that students with low levels of speaking skills may have found the pilot stressful, but one school enjoyed it so much they clapped after the speaking assessment. Khalifa said the test is not meant to trick students or be overly difficult. We tried to minimize the anxiety as much as possible, she said. But the countries involved take the results seriously. Khalifa said that countries that have been helped by PISA have changed their education policies. Some countries have decided to hire more teachers or introduce foreign languages at a younger age, she said. And that is one of the key reasons why we partnered with OECD, Khalifa said. It is about that influence of PISA. I'm Dan Novak.
Dan joins us now on the program to talk a bit more about his story. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, Ashley.
You use the word assessment a lot in the story. Could you explain exactly what an assessment is?
So the word assess is a verb, and it means to estimate or determine the ability of something. Assessment is the noun. It has a similar meaning to the words rating or test.
How will countries be using the results of the PISA foreign language assessment?
They could use it in a number of different ways. Cambridge's expert I interviewed for the story, Hanan Khalifa, told me the results will be measured on a nationwide level. Individual students' or schools' results are not as important for the purposes of PISA. Countries are going to look at how they did and could decide whether to change how they're teaching English, or change when they start introducing students to the language. But the assessment won't be released officially until 2025, so we won't know for sure how countries will use the results until then.
Well, thanks so much for answering my questions, Dan.
You're welcome.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become president of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with four sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money, and he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him, limited government freedom for people, meaning white males. It was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression. He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.